Welcome to another exciting episode of Poetry in the Air, a Right Attitude radio show. This program is brought to you by the Office of Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative that enhances student learning by fostering positive attitudes toward writing. I am your host, Melvina Sykes. This week on our show, poetry is in the air and on the air. We're going to hear from Tim Siebels and Jeffrey Harrison, two incredible poets who visited Savannah State in April 2016 in observance of National Poetry Month. We'll hear Siebels and Harrison read selections of their work, discuss their craft, and talk about some of the kinds of conventions of poetry. Along the way, we'll try to gain a new understanding of how poetry works, what it can do, and why it's important. To all you aspiring poets out there, get your pens ready. First up, we have nationally acclaimed poet Tim Siebels, who has authored 5 full-length collections of poetry. Many of our listeners may recognize his face from a portrait painted by local artist Panhandle Slim, which hangs proudly in Payne Hall right here at Savannah State University. Fast Animal, published in 2012, won the Theodore Retke Memorial Poetry Prize and was nominated for a 2012 National Book Award. Here is Siebels reading his poetry and speaking with Savannah State student writers at a workshop he conducted on campus in April 2016.
Dolores Jepps was a girl that many of us had crushes on in high school. And this book primarily is a book of memories of various kinds. I do mention the Temptations in here. Most of you are at least somewhat familiar with the Temptations. A quintet, okay, yeah, because there are places I go now where people don't know who the Temptations were. So I just figured I should ask that. And I think that's really all you need to know about this one. Dolores Jepps. It seems insane now, but she'd be standing soaked in school day morning light, her loose leaf notebook flickering at the bus stop. And we almost trembled at the thought of her mouth, filled for a moment with both of our short names. I don't know what we saw when we saw her face, but at 15, there's so much left to believe in, that a girl with sunset in her eyes, with a kind smile, and a bright blue miniskirt softly shading her bare thighs, really could be the goddess. Even the gloss on her lips sighed, "Kiss me, and you'll never do homework." Some Saturdays, my ace, Terry, would say, "Guess who was buying T-berry gum in the drugstore on Stem?" And I could see the sweet epiphany still stunning his eyes. And I knew that he knew that I knew he knew I knew. Especially once summer had come and the sun stayed up till we had nothing else to do but wish and wonder about fine sisters in flimsy culottes in those hot pants James Brown screamed about. Crystal Berry, Diane Ramsey, Kim Graves, and her. This was around 1970. Vietnam to the left of us, black Muslims to the right, big afros all over my Philadelphia. We had no idea where we were, how much history had come before us, how much cruelty, how much more dying was on the way. For me and Terry, it was a time when everything said maybe. And maybe being blinded by the beauty of a 10th grader was proof that, for a little while, we were safe from the teeth that keep chewing up the world. I'd like to commend my parents for keeping calm, for not quitting their jobs or grabbing guns, and for never letting up about the amazing, quote, "so many doors open to good students," unquote. I wish I had kissed Dolores Jepps. I wish I could have some small memory of her warm and spicy mouth to wrap these hungry words around. I would like to have danced with her, to have slow cooked to a slow song in her sleek toffee arms, her body balanced between the Temptations' five voices and me, a boy anointed with puberty, a kid with a B average and a cool best friend. I don't think I've ever understood how lonely I am, but I was closer to it at 15 because I didn't know anything. My heart so near the surface of my skin, I could have moved it with my hand. Slow dance. Some days I can go nearly an hour without thinking of the taste of your mouth. Right now, I'm at school watching teenagers fidget through a test. Outside, the sky is smoky and streets are wet, and two grackles step lightly in yellow grass. 2 weeks ago, in Atlantic City, I stood on the boardwalk and looked out across the water. The railing was cool. Broken shells dappled the beach. I had been playing the slot machines and lost all but a dollar. I tried to picture you in Paris, learning the sound of your new country, where at that moment, it was already night. I thought maybe you'd be out walking the street lights, walking with the street lights glossing your lips, with your eyes deep as this field of water. Maybe someone was looking at you as you paused under the awning of a bakery where the smell of newly risen bread buttered the air. I remember those suede boots you wore to the party last December, your clipped hair, your long arms like the necks of swans. I remember how seeing the shape of your mouth that first time, I kept staring until my blood turned to rain. Some things take root in the brain and just don't let go. We went to a movie once, I think it was The Dead, and near the end a woman told a story about a boy who used to sing, how at 17 she loved him, how that same year he died. Right. I mean, I don't know, you're primarily working on memoir, did I hear it, Dr. Ferry said? Okay. Anyway, well, what you'll find, I mean, not all poets do this, but a lot of the work that I do in poetry is the same kind of work you would do in memoir. I mean, most everything in that poem, for example, is essentially a true recollection. I didn't really make any of that up, right? So even though it's a poem, it's still covering the territory related to memoir. And the truth is, your life is your life is your sacred text. If you're gonna write, your life is your text, right? Even though you may observe things outside of yourself, you may look at the world and want to talk about what's outside the world, but still, you're still dealing with your own reactions to what's happened. You're dealing with your own feelings about whatever you see in the world. So it's always your life that is your root, right? And that's why when people sometimes will say, well, do you have to live a difficult life or do you have to be depressed or suffering to write? I would say no. I mean, unless you find your life uninteresting. I mean, unless you've lived a life that you think is just dumb, which, God, I hope most of you don't feel that way or hoping none of you feel that way. There are always things in your life, number one, that probably matter a great deal to you. And there's also a lot of things in your life that will connect to other people's lives. I mean, even though we're all different people, the things that we've experienced usually are not completely unlike, or even not very unlike, the things that other people have gone through, you know? So when you write, part of what you're trying to do is you're trying to, I imagine, Dr. Ferris have talked about this. You're trying to bring to light a certain aspect of your own life so that other people can recognize their lives in your life. It's not so much about that your life is just so fascinating that everybody should care about your life. It's the idea that your life is representative of all lives. Like that you're, for example, Dolores Jepps is one person. None of you know who she is, but probably all of you know what it's like to have a crush on somebody. You know what I mean? So Dolores' name and who she is specifically is not the point, as much as it is she becomes like a symbol, or she stands in for crushes that any of us might have had on different people in our lives at times, right? I don't think I've ever been anywhere where people say, what's it like to have a crush? Everybody knows what that's like, to look at somebody, particularly somebody who you feel is way out of your league. And Dolores, I mean, at least in our young minds, we thought, Dolores is too fine, you can't even talk to her. She's too fine. You know, of course, I don't think she thought of herself like that, but we certainly had all these crazy notions of her. But in the territory of all writing, certainly poetry, but all writing is emotion. Certainly, ideas are important, the intellect is important, but the thing that drives people to write usually is what we feel about our lives. I mean, you may feel smart and you may feel clever, but the thing that will drive you and sustain you as writers is probably what you feel about something. I've never written anything that I didn't care deeply about in the emotional sense. And it's very likely that those of you who are here wanted to be writers because you feel passionately about something that you know or something that you've seen or something that you want other people to see. And I say that to you because so often we undervalue the idea of feeling. We take it for granted that the emotional landscape is just simply understood. But I would suggest to you that it is not, and that that's why people write, is so that we can lay it out in such a way that people can get a clearer sense of how it is that one feels through life or how one feels through a particular experience. Before I wrote that poem, I certainly had memories of Dolores and my boy Terry and all the stuff we thought and said in my head. But in writing the poem, a certain set of feelings or a certain set of understandings becomes clear. Like you think, that really was how it was. And then I mentioned the names Diane Ramsey, Kim Graves, and Crystal Berry. And I hadn't really thought about those names until I started writing the poem. You know, and I think what you've probably already experienced, maybe some of you, I imagine, when you're writing, things come to your mind that you didn't expect to be there. Yes, yes, yeah. That's almost always the case, and that's what I would say. Just in terms of writing, and it doesn't matter what you're writing, whether it's poetry or memoir or fiction or working on a novel. Probably the most important thing you do is to begin. Like, don't wait for the profound moment. I'm waiting for inspiration. Because the inspiration will find you once you start to write. You know what I mean? I don't know if you've talked to him about this, Chad, or not, but the idea that writing is going to probably open up things that sitting and thinking will not. You know, that just the idea of laying down any particular line almost always leads to the next thing, the next line, right? And so I would caution you against ever waiting for the great, brilliant vision. You know, write your way into it. Write your way into the vision, you know, because almost all of us know a lot more than we think we know, and we're often much more deeply affected by our lives than we think we are. And so when you start writing, sometimes you'll discover, wow, that really did matter to me, or I really did feel that way once, or this person really did, you know, resonate deeply in my life. And oftentimes, in the busyness of our daily lives, we kind of skate over the things that matter to us. Whereas when you sit to write, that's when you can invest your heart and soul into it. And sometimes you'll be reminded of the stuff that you care about most, you know? Anyway, any questions or ideas that you want to talk about in terms of your own writing or issues that you wrestle with when you write, or problems, or You worry about writing, I mean, memoir, since you're trying to write the truth. You worry about writing about family. You worry about, you know, who's going to see what you write. Do you worry about these things? No worries, huh? No fear about anything, huh?
I don't really think I tend to worry about the people that I talk about. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's just the subject. Like, I have my idea of what I feel is interesting or what it is that I want to talk about. But then when I start to write it, I'm like, people don't care about this. I tend to downplay whatever it is that I want to talk about.
I see. Well, I would say to that that if you find it interesting, it's a good chance that some other people are going to find it interesting, unless you think you're a complete freak. You know what I mean? So... there has to be a reason why you're compelled by an idea or a moment or a memory. I mean, there's something there. And so I would say, yeah, don't under-imagine how much you hold in common with other people. Because if you're drawn to something, I can't imagine that no one else would be. And the real struggle is in trying to figure out the language that will make this thing that you care about available to other people. That's the battle. I mean... there are a lot of people who have great ideas, but if you can't make them sing on the page, then no one's going to really get what you're trying to say anyway. And that's what takes so much time. I mean, most of us, you know, have had experiences that we feel at least are worth writing about or worth exploring. But to make someone else care about it, that's in the art of writing. That's why... some of you are probably already deeply familiar with the idea of revision. Yes? Are you revising feverishly all the time?
Hopefully.
Okay, because that's the thing. I was just talking about this up at Sarah Lawrence. And the inspiration, lots and lots and lots of people feel inspired to write. But the real writers, the work is in revision. Inspiration is relatively easy, but it's making the thing that moved you available through your writing. That's where all the work is. That's where the write and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. Now, in school, and I know your time is limited, you got other classes. You can't just sit around writing all the time, you know. But in the long run, especially those of you who really care about writing and want to be writers, some of you may just like writing. Some of you might... this is my heart, you know, I'm gonna do this. Those of you who feel that way about it, especially, you will find that at a certain point, revision is your very, very best friend, because it will allow you to do better than your first notion. I remember when I was probably around your age, I would think that the initial inspiration, the thing I wrote first, was so packed with my feelings and my, you know, interest in it, that I didn't want to touch it. I feel so much about this. I dare not do anything but change a comma. But what you find is that's just being drunk on your own interest. That has nothing to do with how well you've written. You know what I mean? That just means you really like it. It doesn't mean it's worth a damn, truthfully, right? And the real work is in sitting back and saying, if I were not me, would I understand what's being written here? Or would I find the feeling or the ideas as clear if I were not myself? Because the thing is, and forgive me, Dr. Fraser, if you've already gone over this, but the thing is, no one else lives in your head but you. And so sometimes you bring to what you've written a certain understanding that is personal. You understand your work a certain way because it's your work. But the art of writing is all about allowing what would otherwise be misunderstood to be clearly understood by someone who is not you, someone who doesn't have necessarily your frame of reference or your experiences, that you would write it in such a way that people could say, yeah, I've known something like that, or I've seen that, or I've felt that. And that's where the work is, and that's where the revision stuff comes from. I'm trying to think of something I worked on for a long time that I could read and talk to you about.
Is that binder that you have right there, Tim? Are those? I see that you've annotated things.
This is the new book.
Oh, gotcha.
And so I'm making the very last tinkering changes on it. So what you see with these all these little little markers that are the pages where I think that line could be different, or that could be more clear, or that's a mistake. I should have had a comma there, and I didn't have a comma. So this is late. This is really late into the process now. So yeah, there's not a lot that I'm changing, but there's still things that that I'm working on. Once it's a book, well, you can't really do much to change it then, you know. So as much as you can, you wanna change it while it's not a book, so that it can be right when it isn't.
That was poet Tim Siebel speaking with Savannah State student writers on how to use their own experiences in their poetry and how to use writing as a method of discovery. Stay tuned. We will be back after our 1 minute break.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yaunt, the director of the Right Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
I am Sarah Dillard, a sophomore majoring in civil engineering and technology at the Savannah State University. As a peer tutor at the SSU Writing Center, I bring you the Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day. Always start your paper with an attention grabber. A fact, quote, or question pertaining to the topic of your essay are commonly used.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back. Now we're going to hear part of the interview with Siebels on the subject of African American poetry, conducted by two Savannah State professors of English, Drs. Camila Martin and Chad Ferries.
So you are a poet and you happen to be African American as well. How do you define African American poetry?
That is maybe the $10 million question. I think if we were talking about the Harlem Renaissance or the Black Arts Movement, I would say that Black poetry is the poetry that is highly focused on the concerns, the defense and promotion of the Black community in America. Mm-hmm. At this point, Black poetry, or the poetry written by African Americans, is so wildly various that I would say, yes, certainly Black people, many Black poets are still dealing with issues of race, representation, identity, the predicament that is presented by a culture that is still largely informed by white supremacy.
Right.
We are still dealing with that. But people are doing all kinds of things that have very little to do directly with the issues of blackness and race. So I would say Black poetry might at this point be too various to define.
Okay.
African-American poetry may be too various to define.
Okay.
We could generalize and say, yes, Black poets still often will engage the issue of race and perhaps class more often than their white counterparts. That would be a generalization, though. You have so many other things that are being explored by Black poets.
What about in terms of style and form? Is there a certain, I heard you talk about the Black Arts Movement, The Last Poets. Is there still something that we can identify as a Black aesthetic in poetry?
Again, really complicated. You have poets who are to varying degrees informed by an interest in Black culture.
Right.
How that would be manifest in style, it could be in a million different ways. You have people who are still very heavily influenced by what they would call a jazz aesthetic, though that in and of itself is very difficult to find. Jazz is also wildly various. But then I was talking to a young brother not too long ago, Quentin, actually. Quentin Baker was a very good poet up in Seattle. He said, yeah, jazz is cool and everything, but most people my age, we grew up listening to hip-hop. Mm-hmm. We didn't grow up listening to jazz.
Right.
So that's an influence on their aesthetic.
Right.
So I would just say, man, you could ask that question in terms of generations.
Sure.
And you might hear people who are in my age range or older talk about maybe jazz being an influence. Mm-hmm. My influences were not so heavily jazz, though I dig jazz. Mm-hmm. I would listen far more to rock, truthfully, and James Brown, the Temptations, etc. than I would of jazz. Jazz I've really discovered more seriously later in life, and I would not say that a particularly important barrier on the way I write. But I would suggest that, again, the varieties of approaches among African-American poets at this point is so broad, it'd be very difficult to talk about a style that would be definitively black. You might, as I said, you might have a variety of concerns that may appear more often in the work of black poets than of white or brown poets. But you know, black poets, we write love poems, poems against the war. You know, I mean, you know, you have the whole spectrum of concern as well, but stylistically, good God, it's just too gigantic. You've got black surrealists, you've got black hardcore realists, you've got black, you know, spoken word artists, you've got black language poets who are doing really strange stuff. I wouldn't know where to begin, really, to talk about, well, this is how black people write, or this is how black poetry operates.
Right.
Too big.
Yeah.
It's too big.
Absolutely. Well, then my follow-up question is, where do you fit yourself into, under the umbrella, if there were one, African-American poetry? How do you fit into that?
Well, that's actually a question I could answer, at least, I mean, maybe not in too complex a way. My influence, as I said, my mother introduced me to the Harlem Renaissance when I was a young teenager. And of course, I grew up during the Black Arts Movement. And so I would say I'm certainly, to some extent, the offspring of those two movements.
Okay.
Now, because of my education, because I was fortunate enough to be exposed to many, many poets, you know, white, brown, Asian American. I mean, I love a lot of the haiku, for example, of Basho. Or, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that I've read that are not certainly directly connected to black culture. So I would say I would be, you know, like a part of a new wave of African American poets that are less confined by issues of race.
Yes.
Whereas I think the poets of the Harlem Renaissance and the Black Arts Movement felt, and rightly, that they really had to address issues of race in a very central way, you know, if not exclusively, often, you know. And I feel at this point, and I think this would be true of many poets, my age and younger, certainly the younger poets now, they're writing about all kinds of things. Race is, of course, among the constellation of interest, but people write about all kinds of things, and I think that's a marker of the success of any kind of movement, that people feel free enough to embrace the full range of their humanity and interests, you know, that they don't feel confined to their pigmentation as a theme, if you will, of their work. So, yeah, I would say I would, you know, like a child of both the Harlem Renaissance, to some extent. Harlem Renaissance would be like my grandfather.
Right.
And the Black Arts Movement would be part of my father. And then I would also be probably maybe a child of mixed heritage, because a number of the writers that I admire and who have affected the way I think about writing are white writers, you know.
Right.
And also South American and European, Lorca in Spain, certainly Neruda from Chile, Cesar Vallejo from Peru. You know, there are others, Octavio Paz from Mexico. So they would also have a say in how I think about writing. It's just too large, isn't it?
Right.
It's too large.
It is.
I'll stop.
Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of it. As I'm kind of teaching at this particular moment, we are in what they call the post-soul aesthetic, you know, 1980s and forward into, you know, the present moment. And, you know, I find my students still kind of grappling with, well, they're writing about this. I've never heard of this. Or I didn't know black people had this experience. And, you know, I'm having to get them to rethink, you know, what it means to kind of write after, you know, and live and experience after, you know, the 60s and the 70s. And I think it also opens up, I think it makes black poetry more inclusive in a lot of ways, because we can also talk about the different ways to define what black is. And, you know, we're crossing continents and you know, I'm in love with the Kenyan-born Somalian but British living writer Varsan Shire, she's really young, but she's just this incredible poet, and clearly she's a person of color, but she doesn't bring to her poetry the same type of understanding of race that we see here in America. And so I'm introducing my students to her work as well, and she kind of looks like you, but her aesthetic and the things that she's talking about moves far beyond color. Yeah. So I think, I think, you know, I'm really proud of what's happening in terms of poetry that's being created.
I think that's the natural, healthy evolution of any social movement, that people would feel, you know, that, that the entire spectrum of experience and interests are at the, are equally theirs. You know, I mean, you have black environmentalist poets. I mean, the earth is, of course, partly black people's too, right?
Well, I think that concludes our conversation. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thanks. Well, those were great questions, Camilla. Really, really smart questions. I hope that my answers were somewhat up to the challenge, because I thought, man, those are good questions.
It was a great conversation.
All right. Well, thank you.
You have just listened to the first part of our show dedicated to award-winning poet Tim Siebels. After our short break, we will begin the second part of our show. We will feature Jeffrey Harrison, one of the selected poets of the 2015-2016 Georgia Poetry Circuit. We will be back in 1 minute, so stay tuned.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yaunt, the director of the Write Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
I am Deanne Goin, a professional writing tutor at the SSU Writing Center, and I bring you the Write Attitude Writing Tip of the Day. Sentences must have a subject and a verb and express a complete thought. Fragments commonly occur when one of the elements of a sentence is missing.
The Write Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Write Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects. And to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back. You're listening to Poetry in the Air, a Write Attitude radio show. Next up, we're going to hear from award-winning poet Jeffrey Harrison, who is the author of 5 full-length books of poetry. Into Daylight, published in 2014 by Tupelo Press, was the winner of the Dorset Prize. Harrison visited Savannah State in April 2016 as part of the Georgia Poetry Circuit, a consortium of 10 Georgia colleges and universities that bring 3 poets of national and international reputation every year to all members' campuses. Savannah State University is the only HBCU member of that group. The poet gave a talk and read poems to Savannah State students.
These 2 poems are older. They're from my 3rd book. But I had them Xerox because there's a lot of different ways to talk about poetry, and sort of they're a little bit artificial, but it's always helpful. There's a, you know, there's different sort of, so I thought I would talk about the difference between narrative and lyric and kind of what that means. I mean, narrative is very easy to define, you know, it tells a story. That's all you really need to say. I mean, that's the definition of narrative. But lyric's a little harder to define. So these 2 poems are both set in upstate New York, where my family has gone for summers for a long time. And so these are both inspired by the same setting, but one is a memory. And memory is automatically narrative, right? You know, you start telling a memory, it's going to be like a little story, and it's a narrative. So that's the lure, that first one. And then the one on the back is more, it's a different kind of thing, different approach. So I like to talk about sometimes how you can write a different kind of poem about the same thing. Like you're trying to write a poem, let's say, about something, and it's not going well. But you know, there are different ways to write a poem about that. You don't have to get stuck on that one. So these are 2 different kinds of poems about the same place. So sometimes you can think of narrative at one end of a spectrum and lyric at the other, but there's a whole continuum in between. So like straight narrative would be everything in chronological order, a story told completely in chronological order, which is kind of boring, right? But that would be like the extreme narrative. Extreme lyric, like lyric would be more musical, using language, that's one aspect of it, using language in a more musical way. So at the very extreme, you might have language so musical that it doesn't even make sense. It's just language for music's sake. But most poems that we write are somewhere along that continuum. They kind of shift, and one's more narrative, but it has some lyric elements. And so that's sort of one way to get a handle on poems. So let's read this poem, Lure. So the speaker, which is some version of me, you know, this kid in the poem, it's based on a real memory. But then you have to make a poem out of it, right? I'll read it first and then I'll talk about it. But lure refers to fishing lures, okay, right? So like you cast them, you reel them in. There's a couple named in the fourth line, Phoebe Wobbler, Daredevil. Those are, I don't know if you guys fish. I don't really fish anymore, but Phoebe Wobbler's a little silver lure that goes like this as you reel it in, and it looks like a little fish. And a daredevil is sort of spoon-shaped, and it's got these cool red and white stripes on it that are kind of curving, and it kind of wobbles around too. And then in the middle of the poem, there's this word Zebco, which is a kind of reel. Like you push the button, you cast the line out, and then you reel it in. All right, so what I'm trying to do in this poem is, you know, write about what happened, but also the word lure is literal, but it also becomes figurative. You know, I'm trying to figure out metaphoric ways to use this word, and you might notice those as I read the poem. Okay, lure. What a sexy name for a piece of fishing gear, said Mrs. Stevens. At 9 or 10, I wasn't old enough to know what she meant. I was casting a Phoebe Wobbler or a daredevil off the end of the dock, and I wasn't getting any strikes. Blonde hair pulled back, a few wisps of it falling across her forehead, high cheekbones, long suntanned legs beneath her short tennis skirt. These were things I didn't pay much attention to back then and remember dimly as if they were underwater. She was probably 10 years younger than I am now. Since this is an old poem, it's more like 25 now, but I couldn't understand why she was making such a big deal about a word. I just kept casting and reeling in the clear line, pushing and releasing the button on my Zebco. I didn't even have to pretend I didn't catch on, and it never got weird being alone with her down there on the dock. The waters of adulthood were unfathomable, though I sensed in the clinking drinks and cocktail laughter of my parents and their friends, something silvery flashing under the surface. Mrs. Stevens could have been up to anything or nothing. Maybe she was just practicing her grown-up talk, or maybe she was flirting, testing me. Maybe she already knew she was going to leave her husband in a few years, listing among her reasons that he wasn't good enough at tennis. He already had the sad eyes of a dog who'd been abandoned by the highway. I saw him 10 years later when I was in college, sitting alone in one of those bars with lobster traps and trophy fish on the walls, fishing nets draped from the ceiling. After our surprised hellos, neither of us found much to say. And as I stood there trying not to look into his bereft face, I thought of how sexy his ex-wife used to be, and what it was like to be a kid, intent on hooking brook trout or rainbows. Rainbows is rainbow trout, but I kind of liked ending the poem on that word since it's, you know, got other connotations. So before I say anything, I don't want to do all the talking. Do you have any questions about it? Like anything confusing or observations about it too? I mean, obviously it's about a kid who's not, he's just sort of becoming aware of sexual things, so it's kind of potentially embarrassing subject matter, but he's also pretty clueless, right? He's still innocent in a way. Are there any words in it you didn't get, or there's not? It's pretty clear. I mean, I try to be pretty clear. There's a few moments that might be unclear. I'm not sure.
When you describe this memory as and the thing that you sort of like this sort of you have this sort of intimation about, like, okay, there's something, and you describe it as like this thing you remember dimly as if underwater. So brilliant, because that is kind of how memory works, right? Like, it's kind of obscured by,
right,
you try to think back on something, it's not quite the thing, it's just sort of a hint of the thing, like,
right,
rippling under the surface of this other thing. But how clever and how beautiful it is, because it's like it's in the set of all of this fishing imagery. The water metaphors extended so perfectly through this whole piece, even at the end when you're in the restaurant,
yeah,
fishing stuff on.
Yeah, that actually happened too. But it was my brother. See, that's like the poetic license part. My brother ran into the guy in the bar later. Yeah.
Oh, and then just again, just an observation, and you know, something really clever is how you're using all of these words, obviously, that are usually associated with fishing, like reeling, and then clear line, and then pushing and releasing. You know, because all these things are happening in other more metaphorical ways in the poem, but they're also real.
Yeah, at least you know, they're alluding to these other possibilities. Sure. So that's that brings up another issue with the memory poem, is that automatically there's the narrator writing the poem now, the adult narrator, but there's also the kid, and at the same time as you're trying to capture the kid's innocence, you're also using language like that, which is the adult sort of alluding to these other things. I mean, this is something that happens all the time in writing. Like, there's a Henry James story, What Maisie Knew, which is famous for, like, keeping the child's point of view innocent, but then there's also the narrator, the real person writing the story, and the language shifts. It's just, it's not something you kind of say, okay, I'm going to put this here, I'm going to put this here. It kind of just happens as you're writing it. You kind of are doing that balancing act, and then maybe you adjust it during the revision process. But yeah, I mean, so it's a poem that's a story, but like a lot of short stories, it's not in chronological order. There's flashbacks and there's flash forwards. Like, there's the thing about maybe she already knew she was going to leave her husband in a few years. So that's one thing. And then there is these places where it's sort of touching back on the fishing metaphor and the sexual metaphor. It's sort of, there's sort of a metaphor running through the narrative. So, and the metaphor is sort of kind of more of a lyric thing. I think of it that way. And I'll talk more about that when I talk about the other poem. But the part that was brought up earlier about remember dimly as if they were underwater, you know, that's maybe the first place where it starts to use this water imagery and fishing imagery. But then later there's something silvery flashing under the surface. There's this something, and that's just the way the Phoebe Wilder moves, you know. So your metaphors, you want them to be kind of coming out of what's already in the poem a lot of the time. Like, once you get stuff on paper, that's like material you can work with. So, that's something silvery flashing under the surface. There's something about the adult world that this kid doesn't get, and part of it's the sexual stuff. So I leave that and tell the story, and then I touch back on that now and then in the poem. You know, it's metaphoric stuff that's kind of outside that main metaphor about, you already had the sad eyes of a dog who'd been abandoned by the highway. I mean, that's not part of the fishing metaphor, but it's like that came in probably because we actually got a dog that way. So it sort of indirectly comes out of my real life again. But everything doesn't have to be completely neat and tidy. Like, that's, you know, somebody might say, well, why are you bringing that in, the dog metaphor? You know, you got all this fishing stuff going on. I just did. And then also, at the end of the poem, used to be much more neat and tidy. And I got published in a magazine with this other ending. And then later, before I put it in a book, I think there were three versions, but it used to end like only the last line was different, I think, but it was pretty different. So, and as I'll go back and read to the ending, and as I stood there trying not to look into his bereft face, I thought of how sexy his ex-wife used to be. So that's the adult, and what it was like to be a kid. And what it was like to be a kid, it was like something like blessedly oblivious to such lures. And it wasn't the word oblivious, I can't remember what word it was, but it was that idea. And then it ends on the word lure. And that can be good because it goes back to the title, it creates closure, it becomes one of those endings that snap shut like a box, kind of. I grew to not like that ending, and then I came up with this more, it's a more open ending that opens out more instead of shutting. But also, it leaves you more in the kid's innocent perspective. I sort of give the last word to the kid instead of the grown-up. If you say oblivious to such, you know, blessedly oblivious to such lures, that's the sort of adult narrator saying that, and you're giving the adult narrator the last word. I kind of liked it better this way. A revision process is kind of a shaping process, and sometimes that's making it more, sort of more and more shapely and nice, but sometimes you want to go mess it up a little bit because it's too tidy. It would be sort of like the equivalent of somebody doing a charcoal drawing, like sort of smearing one of the lines with his thumb or something. You know, it doesn't have to be perfect, you know. In fact, you don't want it to be perfect. So if there's nothing more that you guys have to ask about or say about this poem, we can stay on this poem if you want. We could also go to the next one and do the contrasty thing. So instead of a story, so let's talk about lyric for a minute. Lyric comes from the word lyre, the Greek musical instrument, right? So it's going to be usually more musical. Often they're personal, like a lot of love poems are. We would lyric. Another way of talking about it, especially in terms of narrative versus lyric, narrative is like moments in time, one after the other, or you can change the order. But a lyric is usually one moment in time, or you know, a couple moments, and blown up, and you sort of go into that moment and make something out of it. And then another thing is, if you're pursuing an extended metaphor, this poem ends up doing that, mainly in the second stanza. If you're pursuing a metaphor, that's a different. I think of that as part of the lyric tradition. I'm not sure that really falls in the real definition, but what it does is it gives the poem a different structure than a narrative structure. It's not a story anymore. It's got some other structure, making something out of this metaphor. So it's like if I'd done the lure poem, but only concentrated on the fishing imagery without like really telling that story. So I'll read this first. It's a shorter poem, but it's a little bit. It becomes a little bit harder to follow, but you don't need to worry about that. Like, poetry's not supposed to make you anxious. Like, it's never supposed to make you feel like, oh my God, I'm not going to understand this. You can always, like, there are poems that really are hard to understand that you can, like Wallace Stevens' poem, The Emperor of Ice Cream, you can get some enjoyment out of that poem without actually knowing what it's about. Then when you hear that poem, when you hear what it's about, it's just like, really? But so this one, okay, so I'll read it. Green Canoe. So it's set on the same dock, really. I mean, I would have pushed this green canoe out from the same place that other poem took place. I don't often get the chance any longer to go out alone in the green canoe and lying in the bottom of the boat, just drift where the breeze takes me, down to the other end of the lake or into some cove without my knowing, because I can't see anything over the gunwales but sky as I lie there, feeling the ribs of the boat as my own, this floating pod with a body inside it. Also a mind that drifts among clouds and the sounds that carry over water, a flutter of birdsong, a screen door slamming shut, as well as the usual stuff that clutters it, but slowed down, opened up, like the fluff of milkweed tugged from its husk and floating over the lake, to be mistaken for mayflies at dusk by feeding trout, or be carried away to a place where the seeds might sprout. It's all one sentence. And by the time you get to the ending, you're kind of not sure where you are, but hopefully you're enjoying the language. And in fact, by the time I'm in that second stanza, and especially at the end, I'm inside a metaphor, and I'm pursuing the metaphor to its logical conclusion in a way. But I'm not even sure, like when I wrote this poem, when I got to the end, I wasn't quite sure what I was saying if you went back and thought about what the metaphor was for. So that might be odd to hear, that a poet doesn't know exactly what he's doing, but that's kind of fun, like it's kind of a good feeling to get somewhere where you're not sure what's going on.
And that's negative capability.
I guess so, yeah.
Keats.
Yeah, being in uncertainty. Yes, that's a good point. Like, I like to write my poems where I don't know exactly where I'm going. And that's kind of like, so this poem becomes a little bit like what it's talking about. It's drifting in a certain direction, and I'm not sure where it's going. And then maybe it arrives somewhere. So that's always a nice feeling. But you can see it's a completely different kind of poem, right? It's not telling a story except in this one moment. It's oddly framed. I mean, like, to start a poem, I don't often get the chance any longer to go out alone in the green canoe. So that's a negative and something I'm saying I don't really do much anymore. But then I'm going to do it in the poem. So that's kind of cool, too, because poetry can give you something and take it away at the same time. Like, it can say, you know, I don't do this anymore, but kind of do it in the poem.
You've been listening to poet Jeffrey Harrison discussing the differences between narrative poetry and lyric poetry with examples from his own body of work. After our 1 minute break, you will learn more about Harrison's work.
I'm Dr. Lisa Yont, the director of the Right Attitude Program at Savannah State University. Here's the writing tip of the day.
Hello, my name is LaShante Grant. I'm a student writing fellow tutor at the Writing Center. I'm here to give you some tips on writing. When you are writing for any class, all outside material must be cited, even if your professor has not explicitly stated this. Many instructors expect you to already know that you need to cite. If you are unsure how to cite correctly, it is important to ask your professor so that you are not accused of plagiarism.
The Right Attitude Writing Tip of the Day is brought to you by the SSU Writing Center and the Office of the Quality Enhancement Plan. The Right Attitude is Savannah State University's campus-wide initiative to enhance student learning by improving attitudes about writing. Visit the SSU Writing Center in Payne Hall to get assistance with your writing projects, and to learn more about how you can improve your writing attitudes and skills, visit qep.savannahstate.edu.
Welcome back to Poetry in the Air. Let's hear from the Georgia Poetry Circus, Jeffrey Harrison, one more time, as he explains the possibilities for using humor in poetry to Savannah State Professor of English, Dr. Dustin Michael, in an excerpt from an interview also conducted in April 2016.
On the subject of humor and how, I guess, how important it is, or how, you know, its value in poetry, we often don't think of poems as something that can be funny, you know, like, it has to be about, come to this, when you're presenting it in class and students, it's got to be about love, or it's got to be about loss, or it's got to be some big, heavy emotion.
Right.
And you add these sort of, again and again with your work, you see these very sort of moments of levity.
Yeah. Well, especially after the first two or three books, there are some poems that are funny. I mean, although sometimes at a university or college, you don't get a lot of laughter because they, like you said, they don't know that it's okay to laugh. You know, it's just poetry, so maybe I shouldn't be laughing.
Mm. It's the serious genre.
But if you read to, you know, I read to a group of librarians in Connecticut a while ago, you know, mostly elderly and they mostly female librarians, room full of them. I thought, how's this going to go? And they laughed like you wouldn't believe. I mean, they got it. So, but yeah, so I think the humor is a little bit of what I was talking about before, of sort of expanding the frame or expanding the range of what you do. Because, you know, at a certain point I might have realized, you know, heard a funny story or told a funny story at a dinner party or something, and you realize, wow, you know, why can't that be in a poem? You know, there's some territory I haven't gotten to yet, you know, and then you have to figure out how to write that poem, and
you don't want just to be like, you know, go through the stanza to get the punchline, you know, it has to
yeah, it's gotta come naturally too, even if there are a few of the funny ones where it's actually a story that somebody else told to me, and I said, can I write a poem about that? And that's not usually how I work. But you can't write that poem until you get inside that persona and find the voice of that person and make it you, basically, and make it your experience. And so in some of those poems, there's one called Fork.
I love that poem.
Yeah. And so that it's not that hard to get. Everybody's been humiliated, so it wasn't that hard to get into that persona. And then I put in some of my own experiences, and then I just embellished. And that's another thing. And in the funny poems, the threshold for what you're willing to make up, you know, and take poetic license becomes much, you're willing to do that much more. Like, so you sort of pull out all the stops and have fun with it. I mean, I was having fun writing that poem. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, yeah. It's
the poem, just to bring, I guess, the listener up to speed, is so it deals with kind of getting, you know, terrible feedback back in workshop, marginal comments like awk and
eek. Yeah,
bird sounds, I think, is what you described. And it's just so beautiful, you know, because we've all gotten those, you know, confusing lines circled here or something like that. They don't really explain, and then the pretension of the person
but also,
who wrote it.
Yeah, and so also really kind of a teacher that didn't have maybe the necessary generosity and maybe too much ego, you know. So so it's a revenge poem in a way. And so yeah, poems can come from a lot of different emotions, and revenge is one of them.
Has that poem shaped, I guess, how you do feedback? I mean, like, you're thinking about, okay, well, I don't want to see myself in a poem like Fork ever, right? So I think about it now, and I'm like, oh, yeah, from now on, I'm going to definitely be a little more...
Well, I think...
giving when I do my feedback.
I'd like to think, I'm not quite like that. I mean, every once in a while, maybe I've crossed a line, but usually I think it. I once had a student who said, when I pointed out that there were some cliches, and she said, well, I did that on purpose, and that, I thought that was kind of funny, and I thought but did not say, that's like walking down the street and stepping in, you know, dog shit on purpose, you know. But anyway, I didn't write that down. I didn't put that on her poem. So
there's a Jeffrey Harrison poem out there somewhere, or this guy.
But you know, then that works in a positive direction too. You think about all the interesting things that your teachers have said, and the things that were helpful to you, and those become the more important things. I mean, the Fork poem is, it's funny, but it's just sort of a one-off. You know, the more lasting things are the positive things. I've had a lot of good teachers, and appreciate the things that they said all the way back to high school and definitely college. I had some great teachers, Kenneth Koch and David Shapiro, and a French teacher, you know, who kind of steered me right at a certain point. You know, I was thinking, oh, well, you know, poetry has to be completely original, and I want to write a kind of poem that nobody's ever written before, you know. And I said that to my French teacher as we were walking. His name was Bert Leifmans at Columbia, and he kind of stopped and said, you know, you should just try to write the poems that come naturally, and if they're new, they're new. And that's kind of, you know, been my approach most of the time, yeah.
That was really good advice.
Yeah, really good advice, yeah.
That concludes our episode of Poetry in the Air. Thank you for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed meeting two of our favorite poets and learning more about poetry. We hope our program provided useful information on how to read, write, and revise poetry. Now start moving those pens across the paper. Thank you to those who helped make this show possible, including Tim Siebels, Jeffrey Harrison, Dr. Chad Ferries, and Dr. Camila Martin, as well as the QEP's very own Adriana Oliveira and Dr. Lisa Yant. Thanks to Dr. Dustin Michael, Sierra Walton, and LaKrista Nelson for their help in production, and to Grace Curry at WHCJ for her support. Special thanks to the Georgia Poetry Circuit. Have a pleasant day, and tune in next time for more episodes of Poetry in the Air. I'm Elvina Sykes. Thank you for listening, and keep writing. Don't forget, you can listen to all the Right Attitude radio shows by visiting the Quality Enhancement Plan website, qep.savannahstate.edu. Also, please follow us on Facebook at WriteSSU, Twitter at WriteSSU, and Instagram at Write_SSU.